They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federalist Society.
On Monday, November 2nd, the Illinois Student Chapter of the Federalist Society hosted Logan Byrne for a discussion on the history of presidential power. The following is the recording of that event. We hope you enjoy the interesting discussion.
The Federalist Society was founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. I'm very pleased today to introduce our speaker, who is Logan Byrne. He is a clinical lecturer in law and a faculty fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. He is also the chief executive officer of Matterhorn Transactions Incorporated. He previously worked at Sullivan and Cromwell LLP, and he earned his bachelor's in science in finance at Fairfield University. He was a Fulbright scholar at Queen's University, and he received his JD at Yale Law School. In 2013, he published a book called Blood of Tyrants, George Washington, and the Forging of the Presidency. So now, without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Logan Byrne, and he will talk about presidential powers, a historical perspective on today.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you all. You were saying before, I had high hopes of visiting, getting to see you in person, but the pandemic made otherwise. But this is good. We're doing this, the virtual discussions, keep the conversation going. And I applaud all of your efforts to keep the conversation moving along. And what a great time to have a discussion about presidential powers. My goodness, it is getting wilder by the day out there. I'm sort of getting, you know, reports already of fights at polls from my friends who are sort of being election watchers. So I think it's really a great time to ground all of this in history. And I talk Can you hear me okay? Okay.
Yes. I can. Sorry.
The host muted me for a second. And I was like, oh no, they're done with me already. Anyway, so it's a great time to talk about presidential powers.
Sorry, I think what happened is I was clicking to admit someone into the room and it clicked you instead.
No worries. So what a day to talk about it, because tomorrow, the big election. The moment we've all been waiting for. And I ground this conversation in George Washington. And then I start with that history and then apply it to today. But it seems a little insane. Why would I start this conversation by talking about George Washington? When we're talking about issues of cyber warfare, drone strikes, NSA surveillance, all of these sort of high-tech issues, and George Washington couldn't possibly have imagined any of them. So I seem insane to be talking about George Washington. Well, my argument is that if you strip away the technology and look at the fundamental rights of citizens versus the powers of government, the history ends up being quite enlightening in applying what those historical precedents to today's modern issues. So this is originalism 101, where many people debate how much weight to give originalism. As Justice Kagan said, we are all originalists now. And so the thing is, if you think this history is really interesting and helpful to your argument, use it. If you think it's terrible and you don't want to use it, you still should learn it so you could contend with it. So I think it's important for two main reasons to look at the history. The first is I think it's enlightened of us to learn from the founding Americans what were the rights of the citizens, what were the powers of government, what did they do right, and what did they do wrong? So how can we learn from them, and to, as we're trying to make this a better country over and over again? If that seems a little too starry-eyed for you, there's a second reason, which is what I hinted at before, where, like it or not, this impacts modern law. This is, if you think originalism is silly, it's sort of too bad you need to contend with it, because if only because a majority of justices, judges, academics use precisely this history for at least a starting point, a really important one, for interpreting presidential powers. So what we're voting on tomorrow, or if you've mailed in already, we vote on already, it all comes down to what are the precedents and what are the powers of the presidency. And it seems, you think after all these centuries, we'd we'd have figured out by now. We haven't. So this is the Article 2 is surprisingly brief. And my argument is that they weren't being cagey by doing so. To them, it was glaringly obvious what they meant. And that's because when they said things like the president should be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, and they didn't really elaborate much more on that, it's because they're talking about the guy who was literally in front of the room, George Washington. At the Constitutional Convention, he was standing there as president of the convention. Everyone knew he would be the first president. He ran unopposed. Generally not a good thing in history, but this that time actually was pretty good. It worked out okay. And also looking backward, he had formulated what the American commander-in-chief meant. What were those powers? Well, he had just used them in winning the war for us. So when it came to sort of specifics of what it meant to be the American commander-in-chief, the founding generation just needed to look back to what they had just seen him do. And sure enough, there's been a lot of debate ever since about, the president says I can do this and here are my powers, the executive branch versus sort of in conflict with the Congress, and sort of a back and forth and ever since. So just to, we could continue this conversation as we go and keep applying it to modern times, but just let's start with some stories about where we came from. Okay, so I don't know about you, but in history class in high school and even in college, it was sort of seemed to me as if the founding generation, they sort of were these demigods that divine their answers who divine the answers to sort of these unknowable questions. It could be further from the truth. They were fumbling and they got a lot wrong. But what's really miraculous about them is if you instead of viewing them as demigods, sort of just knew these answers, you see them as sort of human beings and flawed ones, often deeply flawed human beings that struggled and amidst a war came up with these really great ideas, some of them. That makes it even more impressive when you look at the structure and the functioning of the government that we have now that's lasted so long. And, certainly we all have our qualms with it, but it functions, surprisingly well. If you went back and asked them, how would things roll when they're writing the Constitution, they would probably be a little more pessimistic. They didn't know what they meant when they said in 1775, we need to appoint someone as commander-in-chief of the American troops. Or the colonies, they're still colonies at this point, 1775, they're under siege. The British have invaded, they have taken over Boston, and the Americans realize that they need to have a coordinated response. They need to unite the troops under one leader. They knew a lot about what they didn't like about the king's powers. So before there was American commander-in-chief, there was the British commander-in-chief, the king. And some scholars like John Yu point to the king's powers quite a bit. I disagree with that approach. And I just say just look at the Declaration of Independence that came out a year later. And it's basically a laundry list of how they did not like the king's commander-in-chief powers. So they started off the war knowing a lot what they didn't like. They didn't like the way the king was doing things. They didn't like the British model for commander-in-chief. They want to have their own new version of this American commander-in-chief. But they didn't know what that was yet. But they knew one thing. They looked at the history and they knew when you give a military man too much power, what does he do? He tends to keep it, right? So they had to choose in this new experiment of what it meant to be the American commander in chief. They had to choose really wisely. And they chose Washington, as we know. But that was sort of a strange choice in some ways. There were two main contenders, so Washington and a man named Charles Lee. Charles Lee had a lot more military experience. He had fought across Europe for the British forces, a brilliant tactician. But he was sort of the guy, he walked around a pack of dogs. He ended up getting caught at a brothel at one point. Not exactly the strong moral figure you want to create this new American concept around. So instead they chose Washington, who had much less military experience. He had fought for the Virginia militia during the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, arguably the first world war, since it involves major powers on multiple continents. And Washington actually helped start it. He helped ignite the war due to a blunder he made. So he was young, trying to make a name for himself. And he tried, the British and the French had been fighting for the Ohio River Valley. And he went up there and he was convinced by some of his allies, a Native American tribe in this case, to attack a French party that he thought was going to attack him. Sure enough, they were a French diplomatic party. And when word got out that he attacked them, it helped ignite that French and Indian War. So Washington, this is just a good example of Washington had some blunders in his military history. But what did he have? What did the colonists see in him that they wanted to choose him? Well, he had what they called the martial dignity. He was a principled man who they thought they could create this new concept of American commander in chief around. And he conveyed a sense that he would respect the rights of citizens. This was really important to them. They knew one thing. They knew they were really, it's really important that he not become a new king and that instead he respect the rights of citizens. This is the whole point of the fight for liberty, right? Okay, so they send Washington, despite his sort of lackluster military record, up to Boston. At this point is June of 1775, and we have about 8,000 British redcoats besieged within Boston by about 20,000 American militiamen. These are farmers, merchants, you name it, guys with guns. And they weren't very well trained, but we have numbers on our side, 20,000 versus 8,000. And Washington makes the obvious decision, we should invade Boston. We should bombard the city with the cannon, and we should have a military victory. But he doesn't. Instead, he goes back to Congress, the Continental Congress at this point. He says, "And the mother, may I approach the commander in chief? Congress, may I invade Boston?" And Congress comes back and says, "No, you may not. You will damage one of our most important cities." And Washington says, "Okay, as you wish." He's establishing civilian control. This is a big break from history in the way that such tactical decisions would not be the commander in chief's decision alone. Instead, he has to go back to this political body and ask them. And this body with very little military experience themselves says, "Politically speaking, you cannot." So Washington says, "As you wish." And sure enough, we pay dearly for it, because the British, their next point of attack is New York City. New York City, the best port around, and the British have the most powerful Navy. And so of course everyone knows that they need New York to be their base of operations to subdue the colonies. And Washington goes to New York City after the British had escaped Boston, and he starts trying to defend the island. But even Washington, with his, you know, mediocre military history background, he goes to Congress and he says, "Well, if I'm fighting the most powerful Navy on earth and I have virtually no Navy of my own, perhaps I shouldn't try to defend an island, right?" And John Adams, as the president of Congress at this point, he writes with no sense of irony. He says, "I have no military experience, but politically speaking, it is imperative you make a stand at New York City." And Washington says, "Again, as you wish." And we are trounced. In the Battle of Long Island, the Americans are pinned against the East River. And they And the only thing that ends up saving us is a nor'easter, which is these nasty weather patterns we get here in the Northeast, where there's whipping wind and rain off the Atlantic Ocean. And when it's coming from a northeasterly direction like that, it's sort of the perfect setup so that you can't, the British ships couldn't get up the East River to encircle us. So we're pinned against the East River, but the ships can't get up because of the wind. So it allows Washington uses that storm to escape. He escapes into Manhattan. And there's all sorts of, you know, great stories about that great escape. Anyway, so then he's in Manhattan and he goes back to Congress again. And he says, that went terribly. I need to retreat inland. And Congress says, no. And then Congress does what Congresses do best. They start a committee and they send that committee to have the Staten Island peace talks. And they talk to the British leaders, and the British had just trounced us. So they're not in a very forgiving mood. And they say, if you want peace, sure, you can have peace, except all of your leaders will be hanged. At that point, the Continental Congress gives Washington the okay to retreat. But it's too late because the British are invading across the East River. The storm is over and they're invading across the East River. And Washington is trying to escape from Manhattan into New Jersey. And then as he's escaping through New Jersey, the British are trying to, quote, bag the fox. That's Washington, because everyone knew Washington was the unifying force that was holding the army together, sort of his leadership. He was the type of guy that in the battles, he'd be in the front lines charging. In fact, and as he was retreating through New Jersey, the Battle of Princeton, there's a great story that's told and lots of the journals of the soldiers, in which there's a volley between the two sides, and Washington is right there in the front. All the other British generals will be far back watching from afar. Washington was on his horse, literally charging in the front lines. Then he was caught between the two volleys of fire. And the soldier said, I put my hat over my head because surely the general had to have been hit. But then from the smoke, boom, the voice, it's a fine fox chase, boys, charge. And Washington was really that kind of leader. And so he was the inspiration. And Washington was not only inspiring in his courage, he also was brilliant in that he saw the war in a different light. So rather than viewing it as traditionally in war, when whatever side ends up with the land after the battle, they've won that battle. Washington didn't care as much about holding land. Instead, he saw the political dimensions. So not being a traditional military man, he looked at the political dimensions of this, which was, as long as I can keep the Continental Army together and the British are having to fight a war across an ocean, I'm draining the British taxpayers. And he's thinking of the politics of this. But in the meantime, that means he's losing pretty badly, battle to battle. To which point it's by December of 1776, he had lost the Battle of New York. He had been chased through New Jersey. And think of the war from the eyes of the Continental Congress. They were in Philadelphia and in Penn's Hall. I'm not sure if you had a chance to ever visited that. It's a pretty place. But think about the geography here. So it's no longer a war that's a far off in Boston, or at least even New York is a New Jersey away. They're literally at your doorstep. And they've just said at the Staten Island Peace Conference that they want you all hanged. So at this point, Congress changes its tune and they grant Washington with what they call dictatorial powers. I know how that sounds. That's a dirty word today. They would hear a dictator and they would think of the Roman Republic, the ancient Roman Republic, in which the Senate, when the Republic was under grave threat, the Senate would disband and they give all the power to one man. And then he'd hopefully use that to repel the threat and then hopefully give it back. Didn't always work out that well. And the Americans knew this. But Washington had shown them time and time again, he was willing to defer to the civilian authorities. He was willing to, he was adamant about protecting the rights of the citizens themselves. So they thought they could trust him. However, we had one major problem. We're not the Roman Republic. for the sovereign is not the Senate. The Senate, as it was with the Romans, the sovereign was not the Congress by any means. It was we the people. Now, granted, we the people were white men could vote. White women were citizens, but sort of disenfranchised citizens, and their husbands would vote for them. People saw the hypocrisy there at the time, like Abigail Adams wrote a lot about that. And as well as other, ethnicities were, of course, often, not allowed to vote. But the point of that is to say that the we the people was a much more dispersed group than the Senate. So if you just disband the Roman Senate, give all the information, all the power to one man, okay, that's one thing. But if you disband Continental Congress and you strip all the powers from we the people and give it to one man, no matter how virtuous he is, you are being just as bad as the king. You're doing just like the king if you're taking their liberties away. That's the whole point of the war. So what do? We're Americans. We innovate. We've been an innovative country from the start. And so we learned from our history and gave all the military power to Washington. So he became what I would call a military dictator, which again sounds terrible to our ears, but to them it would mean that when it came to military matters, power over his troops, making tactical decisions, dealing with prisoners of war, he had a lot more discretion. No longer was it the sort of mother may I approach to commander-in-chief from that day, from December 1776 on through the rest of the war. That was an empowered George Washington. But then the political power remained with we the people. So what does that mean? So it meant that the citizens kept their rights, which was quite unheard of throughout history. Washington was the only major revolutionary figure to never declare martial law or strip the Americans of their rights. This was a big break. He was making a bold statement in doing so. And so just one quick example of how this played out in a practical sense, and we can start applying that to all sorts of today's issues because it keeps coming up over and over again about the powers of the presidency. Okay, so everyone knows Benedict Arnold, the great traitor, right? So people don't focus on the fact that he was actually one of our most important military officers early in the war. He was a brilliant tactician. He was also sort of a quarrelsome guy. There's all these stories about how he got in all these fights with his business partners, and he shot a Frenchman he found alone with his sister, that kind of thing. And he was also loved the British fineries and seemed more like a Brit in his dress and demeanor than he did like the sort of the more rough and tumble patriot stock that was fighting under him. So he wasn't very well liked, even though Washington respected him as a military leader. So sure enough, some important battles like the Battle of Saratoga, one of the turning points of the war, in which the French started to side with the Americans. That was mostly thanks to Arnold, but his superior Horatio Gates, or Granny Gates, as Arnold called him, took credit. So Benedict Arnold becomes disgruntled with the American cause. He sees all these losses. Everyone thinks we're going to lose. He thinks, okay, well, I don't want to be hanged, and also I'd rather be with the winning side, and I can make a lot of money doing so. Arnold was a great businessman. Washington was also an excellent businessman, even better than Arnold, but focusing on Arnold for a second, he said, okay, well, how can I make the most money? And he decides that the goal is to take control of West Point. Has anyone visited West Point? Anyone? It's a beautiful, it's a beautiful, if you get a chance to go, up from New York City in New York along in the Hudson Valley. It's this beautiful hook in the river. And right now that hook's very, Instagram worthy. A lot of wedding pictures are often taken there. Back then they would view it instead as the British ships needing to tack and go around that bend, making them quite vulnerable to cannon fire. So this is the perfect place for a land-based defense. Remember, Americans don't have much of a navy at all, and they're fighting the most powerful navy on earth. And the British are desperate to take control of the Hudson River. So if they could connect the New York City to Canada, they control both via the Hudson using their Navy, then they've encircled the rebellious New England colonies. And they could pretty quickly end the war that way. The Americans know this, Arnold knows this. So they decided to have that land-based defense at what was originally called Fort Arnold. And so Arnold goes, he has this plan where he's going to use the Americans' own people to draw up the plans of the fort. And then create a dance with the British in which it would make it look like Arnold put up a defense, but actually give it over very quickly. And then he could possibly escape and then ask Washington for command of another crucial installation and give that one away too. And so luckily for us, he was working with two men. The first, and their nationalities are important here. So the first man was a man named John Andre. He was a British intelligence officer, young man. He's about 22 years old. He is, there's all these interesting stories about how he escaped. He fled the UK because his fiancée dumped him. He's much more into poetry than warfare, sort of a likable character. And he is beloved by the British because he's thoughtful and smart. And he decides he's working with Arnold for this to orchestrate this dance. And then they're also working with an American loyalist named Joshua Het Smith. So we've got the Brit, Andre, and then the American Smith. Smith is a loyalist, what the Franklin referred to as disgusting snakes and toads. They hated this segment of the population. So about 20% of the American population were loyalists. 40%, so a minority, were patriots. And the other 40% sort of didn't want to be involved, or they would change their sides. So think about this. This is 20% of your population is opposed to your whole cause. That's a big chunk. And this is a really, especially in the South, they would often take up arms against you. They sort of join the British and fight against you. And in many ways, the American Revolutionary War was a civil war. But if you go back in history and you ever look at the sort of the way societies treat the most hated in their population and sort of if they afford them their rights or not, that tells you a lot about their principles. And for Washington, as much as he despised these people, he protected their rights. Again, this is unheard of. This is, you know, and many people thought it was madness in some ways because we're sort of losing the war. There's this whole segment of the population. Why are you protecting them when they're trying to help us lose this war? People are dying over this. But Washington said, you know, it's more important that we establish this country and liberty correctly if it's going to endure. So Arnold is working with these two men, the American and the Brit, and he meets with them at West Point. And they are sending the plans for this dance back to New York City, where the British are. Luckily for us, they're caught on the way. And Washington goes over to Smith, and this is the American. He says, "I have enough evidence to hang you on yonder tree." But he doesn't. Remember, Smith is American. So he affords him due process. And Smith gets a two-week-long trial. You're all going to be excellent attorneys, I'm sure, but don't do this. He defends himself. And his argument is, as an American, there's a high burden of proof and need to show that I knew what I was doing was wrong. I was just following orders from an American officer, which Arnold was. I didn't know he was betraying the country. And you sort of read Smith's own autobiography, and it's sort of even not that believable when you read it in his own words. But sure enough, he gets off. And as much as Washington wanted this man dead, and he most likely deserved it, it was more important to Washington to set that precedent, that the rights of the citizens were being protected. But then what do you do with Andre? This is the more lovable guy. Hamilton thought he was great, became sort of friends with him when he was in captivity. And his argument was, hey, you caught me with military intelligence. I'm a British intelligence officer. I was just doing my job. So you keep me captive and you trade me or whatever. Too bad Washington had him hanged in 2 days. Washington was sending another strong message, and that was he had a lot more discretion now over the rights of foreign nationals and wartime affairs. And if you threatened his people, he could be quite ruthless. So that, with that precedent in mind, it creates for today, and you'll see this over and over again with sort of the Supreme Court decisions, political battles today, about this sort of the highest, the presidency at the height of its power versus the lowest ebb of its power. And there's a divide between, it's based on who you're dealing with. So if you're looking at overseas affairs, dealing with foreign nationals, this is wartime authority, this is even extending into immigration. When you're dealing with foreign nationals, the president historically has a lot more discretion, and the courts have deferred to them. But then if you sort of look at the other sphere in which you're dealing with the citizens themselves, that's when it's much more, the history would instead say it's Congress's role to be to dealing with that, dealing with them. And sure enough, Washington, the courts kept functioning as much as possible. The kind of the Congress kept reconvened, and the citizens kept their rights. So we can go many different ways with this. Maybe I'll set up one topic of conversation that might be interesting. This is the idea of surveillance. This is, I remember Edward Snowden a few years ago now, he had the leak in which he said that the NSA was spying on foreign nationals and also citizens' home here in domestically and citizens abroad. I definitely take a lot of issue about the way he approached it. I think his leak was quite dangerous and reckless and bad in many ways. But I guess at a high level, at least we have him to thank that we have this conversation about, and we know what's happening. So at a high level, a little bit of information is helpful. I think he went way beyond what would have been helpful to instead endanger our foreign assets. And within 2 weeks of his leaks, 8 different Al-Qaeda linked cells changed their mode of communication because he provided so much detail, and not just sort of what was happening, but the how and the nitty-gritty of how we were doing it, that he actually sort of empowered, actual legitimate surveilled to change their mode. So I think, very dangerous, but sort of stepping back to the broader issue of surveillance, what would Washington say? What would are the powers of the presidency when it comes to surveillance? Well, when you're dealing with the Andres of the world, the foreign nationals, the president would have a lot of discretion. This under Edward Snowden, it was President Obama. I've seen nothing to see that President Trump has really changed much in this realm of surveillance. And that it would say that both presidents have a lot of discretion when it comes to who they spy on. Now, maybe if you're spying on the leaders of Europe and your allies, don't get caught like we did. That's not great, but sort of it is the president's prerogative to do so. If you want to spy on Merkel's cell phone, text messages, it's the president's prerogative to do so. Policy-wise, you probably shouldn't get caught, but we did. And then when it comes to sort of foreign nationals, again, we have policy discussions why, but I'm speaking in terms of the powers of the presidency versus Congress. The president was sort of certainly in his right to do so. But what happens is with this NSA surveillance is it ends up being 2 hot warrants, where if what starts with a foreign national being surveilled quickly encompasses Americans as well. So this is the idea where, I'm in country XYZ and I'm a legitimate target for surveillance, but then my cousin I talked to and he's in country ABC, and then his friend lives in New Jersey. So sort of the 2 hops away, that means the person in New Jersey also being surveilled because they're 2 hops from the person. And with today's communication, just think of all your social media friends and then all their friends. It very quickly gets to lots of Americans, regardless of what part of the world you're surveilling. And then that's what the problem with that is, that you're jumping from the Andres of the world to the Smiths of the world, in which they're 2 very different spheres. Again, with the Americans supposed to be under, protected by Congress and have their rights protected for surveillance measures, they were getting caught up in sort of more dragnet type searches, which exactly the sort of thing that the Fourth Amendment was concerned with. But I'm going to stop and try to get some questions. I could certainly keep talking about all sorts of things, but I want to make sure I'm not missing anything that people want to hear about.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, any participants, you can use the raise hand function to start, and you can unmute yourself. But yeah, there's a lot that's been covered already. Sure. I guess I have a question. I mean, it's one of the clear, as you talked about George Washington, like going to Congress before he was granted these dictatorial military powers. And I mean, I kind of see that maybe a little bit as the precursor of the war powers. Mm. You know, clearly we've almost abandoned that since World War II. Do you have any comments on, am I right in seeing it that way?
That's a great parallel. So the War Powers Act has been, you know, each president, regardless of party, has said that, you know, in one way or another, it's not legal. And the Washington example and the precedent there would suggest that, you know, that based on that history, it is the president's prerogative to make these sorts of decisions, you know, not asking for permission, but maybe reporting afterwards. And so the War Powers Act, to the extent it does ask for sort of, you know, only provides for, you know, certain time period for the president to act and then requires the Congress's permission, they're almost reverting back to that early war Washington, Mother May I, which was sort of, you know, thrown to the wayside of history because they tried that and it obviously didn't work. So my argument, and you know, you'll see this in various briefs and decisions, is that the history that matters is sort of they're grappling with these sorts of issues during the war, and they came with sort of the practical realities of warfare, and one of those very clearly to them was that you need an empowered commander. So Washington just then, he only had commander in chief powers back then. And I sort of see that as the nugget that became a central part of the presidency, you know, just a few years later, several years later. And that that concept that it was the American commander in chief and then the president's power to make those sorts of strikes. And it shouldn't be in their mind, you know, may I attack Boston? It was sort of, you know, tell, you know, attack first and then make, you know, you can inform Congress later, but less of a asking for permission. History would go against that. One thing that I think, unless there's other questions, one thing I'd like to bring up is, it's interesting, and I always find it so fascinating about how, think about today versus then. You know, everything's terrible now, and actually 2020, they are pretty terrible, but at least we're not under active invasion and losing. So back then, and then look at what they did to protect the rights of citizens during that active invasion. Early in the war, the Patriots started opening all the Loyalist mail. This is sort of like the Dragnet searches. This is sort of the NSA surveillance, where just surveil everyone. You know, we think they're a bad guy and they're being a traitorous person, just surveil them. And they started doing that, but then very quickly they realized, wait a second, we're violating their liberties. This is the whole point of the war. As much as we think they're wrong and they're terrible people, we still need some sort of process because they're Americans. And there definitely was no concept of sort of world citizen back then. It was not just not the way they perceived the world. It was sort of very much an us and them mentality. Anyway, so what they did was they formed a whole last work of committees on correspondence to have a process in place where they'd look and say, okay, well, Alex, you're suspect because of XYZ reasons, so I have probable cause to search you, versus the king used to provide mandates to certain officers and say, oh, by order of the king, everyone empty your bags. So one, focusing on Alex with, you know, probable cause, that's good law enforcement. We want that. We want to catch bad guys. Like Alex most certainly is. But then the other would be to, just kidding, Alex. And then and the other sort of the British dragnet search, where everyone open your bags by order of the king, that's a grievous transgression against their rights. Something, one of the reasons we fought the whole war. So what they form are these committees, and they could look and to have some sort of due process to say, hey, no, I suspect this person's a loyalist and they're doing whatever thing, and here's my probable cause. And you think about that, that's how important it was to them to protect the rights of citizens and have due process, that they're willing to expend all of these resources doing this while they're in the middle of a war and losing badly. And then you sort of, you fast forward to today, you see with everything going on, sort of like, oh, well, you know, how can we possibly, you know, care about this, or with everything, it's so dire. I would say, well, look at our history. This is, just sort of, you know, on the surveillance thread, which we could certainly hop onto other threads as well, like drone strikes and things like that. On the surveillance thread, because it keeps coming up in some of the conversations and debates, people are it's getting worse and worse. So look at, you know, what's happening in China. Sort of, it's, you know, there's some really weird Big Brother stuff, you know, being reported recently in the news, where people are getting social points and sort of how politically correct they're acting, or like if your sister says something bad as the Communist Party, then you lose points, and then those points mean you won't get government appointed jobs. There's even sort of pretty credible reports saying weird things like how much toilet paper you get in the public restrooms. There's a tie-in, and they use this surveillance system that they have there actually quite effectively in battling COVID. This is why they were able to do so much better than we were, because everyone's so closely surveilled. I guess in that sort of has its perks as well as its, you know, major downsides, I would argue. And anyway, so the technology has really caught up to sort of where you can do so much with facial recognition. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves of the country, where did we come from, and which sort of liberties are we willing to cede in the name of security? There's a famous Franklin quote, where those who would trade an ounce of liberty for a pound of security deserves neither and will get none. I think that ends up becoming true. And sort of, so if you look at, you know, rewind, applying the committees and correspondence and making sure there's due process today, it is important. And one thing just sort of to discuss is, Congress. So where is Congress on all of this? We sort of had, over the last several decades at this point, a presidency that's becoming more and more powerful. And this is, you know, the presidents have been seeking that power, but that's sort of what the founders thought would happen. Sort of, they thought each branch of government, and sort of the brilliant ideas of separation of powers and checks and balances, that they, each side would seek more power. But what they expected would be that the other branches would check them. And Congress has more and more been ceding that power very willingly. It seems to be more politically expedient for them to not vote on anything, so that there's nothing that their opponent in the next election could point to, like, oh, well, you voted for this. And this sort of, one thing that I find troubling is the lack of compromise these days, because if anything in a bill, and every bill, if everyone's perfectly happy with a bill, then, you know, it's miraculous and also probably scary, because there's something wrong there. You know, any kind of compromise means no one's 100% happy with that bill. But now, rather than do that, they'd rather sort of, you know, do very little. And where I think I really felt Congress especially is in these types of areas. For example, surveillance. When the Edward Snowden leaks came out, high-ranking congressmen and women, they came out and acted surprised, as did President Obama. They said, like, oh, we didn't know this was happening. Well, that's either terrifying because they really didn't know, or they're just lying, which I'd actually prefer they be lying, because it's even more terrifying that there's sort of this black holes of information within the executive branch that they actually are so shielded and insulated from scrutiny from the branches of government. I think that actually is very concerning. But sort of the way that it was supposed to work was, the history was, military intelligence can't have full transparency. No one is, you know, lives in some sort of la-la land where they think that you could just tell all of our military experience. You know, in fact, I said, you know, with the Snowden leaks, it was so dangerous the way he did it, because too much transparency is horrible for us all, you know? But what the way it was supposed to work would be the back in the day, they had these committees would have, you'd have sort of trusted individuals that were elected or appointed by your legislature, which was elected, or, you know, they took on different forms, but there was some sort of democratic underpinnings there, in which these people could then be trusted to view this information and be scrutinizing to make sure that the rights of citizens were not being trampled. And today that would be Congress. So Congress would be our elected officials who are supposed to be protecting us. So that, you know, they can't reveal everything, but that whole point was we're supposed to have trusted elected officials who were reviewing this. And it seems like they weren't. So I really definitely fault Congress for falling down the job and doing their constitutional duty of scrutinizing the executive branch. And the executive branch scrutinizing Congress as well, not sort of, you know, as we saw in the impeachment hearings, it's not that, you know, the executive branch is not subservient to Congress by any means. You know, for example, the obstruction of Congress charge, that, you know, never made sense to me back during the hearings. Anyway, but so, yeah, so I think that the way, and so what do we do? Well, so there's some tactical thoughts and then some sort of, you know, bigger picture thoughts on that. So technically speaking, when it comes to government surveillance, for instance, I think, you know, there is room for some more transparency. I think that the, you know, having old FISA courts decisions that are no longer pressing. So they're from 2001, 2002. They're not active intelligence going to get someone hurt. Can you release some of that so that smart law school students like yourselves can be looking and see the reasoning that the FISA judges were using? I think that that has two benefits. The first is it makes sure that we can verify and provide more legitimacy to the courts, that people are looking at this outside sources, and you know their logic is sound, or criticize them if it's not, which we should do. And then the second thing is it sort of creates legacy concerns for the FISA court judges. Now, granted, everyone I've met that's sort of involved in this process, from the NSA or otherwise, they seem like really like good people. That's not my worry. My worry is all with these things, what always happens in history is it starts off with a really good idea with really good people, and then it goes south. That's the problem. It's sort of, you know, where does this go as you fast forward the years go on? So to the extent that we have some transparency, for example, the FISA court decisions, some of them being opened up for scrutiny, I think that's a good first step. And then the second is broader, and this really comes back to the election we have tomorrow. And that is your president, your Congress, they need to be really held accountable. They sort of need to be vote for people that, you know, do what they say and say what they do. And I feel like too often these days, it's sort of, you know, picking from a lesser of two evils. So I highly encourage when I have these discussions with, you know, good citizens, which you are. The fact that we're having this conversation, you're going to law school, you're getting education, we're having this conversation about these important ideas. You're all doing your duties as American citizens, which, I would love for more people to do so. But also run. You know, if you don't like people who are running, please run yourselves. And don't forget local politics. Local politics actually have a lot more impact on your life often than sort of national politics. National politics are so interesting as well. But run locally. Be involved. Be reaching out to be involved in campaigns for different levels. Please run yourselves if you don't like the candidates. Just keep speaking up. And I think sort of the biggest worry I have is that people sort of sliding into complacency, and they think that the system's just broken, we can't fix it. I don't think the system is broken. I think that there's certainly plenty of room for improvement. Absolutely, there always has been, and there probably always will continue to be so. But I think it's an ingenious system that our Constitution has created that provides the mechanisms for correcting itself. But sort of the most important part of that mechanism is incumbent upon us. George Washington wrote, and it really stuck with me. He said, "The foundation of our empire was laid not in a gloomy age of ignorance and superstition, but an epoch when the rights of mankind were better understood and more clearly defined. In this auspicious period, the United States came into existence as a nation, and if its citizens should not be completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own. So I hear that and think has directly charged each and one, every one of us to you know, take control of our country, our local politics, and really be involved, be informed, be speaking out, of course, be voting tomorrow. And I think that's really incumbent upon all of us to continue that great history. Alex, do you have a question?
Yes, I did. I just I figured how to, didn't want to interrupt you, especially since it was so interesting. I'm kind of wondering, because one of the, seems like, and you touched on it pretty clearly, the distinction, or at least one of the things that was similar to, for example, how back in revolutionary times, you know, there were the dragnets looking through the loyalist papers, and then kind of that, you know, they decided to end that and create a process. And then today you have, you know, the way the FISA courts work. I don't really know much about those courts, but I'm wondering that what's consistent about them is the, or not consistent actually, but is the element of transparency. So back in, you know, say what you will, in the revolutionary times, it was open. Maybe it was shameless that they were doing these kinds of things. And then it kind of came out and enough people decided it was bad. Now with the FISA courts, there was very little transparency, I think, from the very beginning. And now there's more demand for it. But what I'm wondering is then how, especially in the context of like the powers, you know, between the separate branches, how would you preserve the value of transparency, which seems to be increasingly, you know, maybe with, you know, with all the bureaucracy, much harder to maintain?
Yes, and it's a tricky balance. You know, I don't want to sort of you know, make it seem simple. And you know, during the Revolutionary War, they, you know, you're right, in the beginning it was sort of very much blatant, you know, this person's a bad guy, let's go get them, you know, let's go open their mail at least. And then they, you know, they started the committees to look for due process in order to open the mail, which were much, they weren't very transparent, but they were sort of, again, sort of, you know, trust to people that via that are selected via some sort of election to do so. The FISA courts, you're right, they're from the start, they were quite secretive. And this is a tricky balance, because I don't want to sort of, you know, say that they're doing something necessarily bad. And sort of the courts, I think, are, you know, a reasonable way to protect military intelligence, but have checks. But then you start looking at things like they approved historically 99% of all warrants requested. Now, that's not quite fair, because they, those, you know, if the way the system typically works is if you get word or some sort of indication that they're not going to approve your warrant, you just withdraw it. So that definitely boosts the numbers. But still, you know, it's just sort of, it's a flag, sort of a, not a red light, a yellow light, that, you know, are they, you know, can, is this system, even if it's functioning well or, you know, above board now, it sort of has the trappings that could lead to major problems on the road. Sort of if the system, you know, if the those requesting the warrants are working so closely with those who approve the warrants, does that lead us down a road in which they could be in cahoots, even if they're not now or they haven't been? And so I think that the transparency balance is a difficult one, because again, you don't want to be revealing everything. But the transparency, you know, one, the mass transparency we talked about, I think is really important about showing the public, you know, decisions, information about the processes, things like that, so that we could, you know, as good citizens be checking. And then more specifically, our elected officials, who were supposed to be the trusted people, supposed to be scrutinizing this sort of thing and having the checks and balances. So particularly I'm talking about Congress here. They should, you know, A, make sure they have the access that they need. This is not a partisan thing, just, you know, everyone, they should have access. This is the way the country's supposed to work. And B, make sure they're using it. That's what I'm actually more worried about. You know, it's just based on some of the conversations and speeches that I've seen since about the end state surveillance, you know, I would fault a lot of the, you know, some of our elected officials in Congress of, you know, not adequately doing their job, or at the very least, not doing a good job of communicating with us what they're doing. Do I have another question here?
We do have a question from Sarah, if she's still here. Sarah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming, and I really enjoyed your talk and appreciated it. And just in light of how some people like to treat American history now, I just find it very enlightening and refreshing. So I just want to say thank you. And then I guess I wanted to have some, if you had any recommendations for books that we could read in terms of, you know, learning more about American history. I know that from my understanding, they don't, in law school, they don't teach, you know, the originalist perspective of reading texts and stuff. And so I was just wondering what you would recommend.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's a you know, big disservice, because as I started the conversation, this is, it doesn't matter if professors like originalism, you need to, you know, you need to either fight it or use it for your arguments. You sort of, you need to contend with it. And it's just like, this is the way the world is, you know, maybe, and I don't think that, you know, people, you know, have certainly have their right to try to change the world, but sort of, you know, the way to do so is not by ignoring reality. Anyway, so yes, so I think originalism, I think it's very smart to look to other books. I think one, I think you nailed it, just learn about the history itself. I think, you know, too often there's a divide between historians and legal historians, and in which sometimes, you know, historians get upset with we legal historians because they, you know, don't like our, they say, oh, no, that's presentism, you can't do that. And it's like, well, we're lawyers is exactly what we have to do. I mean, we have to take it and apply via analogy. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure we're putting things in their context. And that's exactly what we need to do. So, but I think sort of you know, focus your lawyer mind on history books like Ron Chernow's Washington of Life is a great one. You know, I definitely love that one. Or some great books on Lincoln and, you know, Team of Rivals. I enjoyed that. It's really a good, easy, nice read. And then, yeah, and then sort of, yeah, it's, you have to, you know, there's all sorts of discussions on originalism, and you could go down a path of all different types of originalism. And so, my friend Jack Balkin, he wrote a book on the living constitutionalism. What's the name of it? I don't actually agree with him and his approach to it, but it's actually super interesting. And I think that's a great one. It must be, what was it called? Living Constitution, I think it was called. So, but he, you know, it's a great one to sort of, living originalism. Thank you, Josh. That's a good one to sort of to challenge your views of originalism and think about the different ways that, you know, the problems with it and the benefits of it. He has sort of a very interesting, Jack Balkin is a great, brilliant man. So definitely take his views seriously. And then finally, Akhil Amar's books are really good. Again, definitely, you know, Akhil and I often debate each other. He tends to be on sort of the more liberal side of things. But he's a great legal historian, has a lot of, and really takes originalism very seriously, as he should. And I think that's why I think I'm trying to remove ourselves from sort of the divide between liberal versus conservative originalists. And, you know, again, Justice Kagan said, we're all originalists now. So I definitely applaud your efforts, and definitely reach out to me. You know, if, and this goes beyond, we're coming up on the hour here. If I could be any help with whether it's learning about originalism, whether it's just sort of in your careers, you're going to school and looking for jobs and a terrible time. And I'm, you know, I'm here to help. So please reach out to me, keep in touch. I would be honored to be of help and advice connecting with people. Then, oh, Dina Mars' brother. Oh my goodness, really? Oh yes, I actually did know that. That's ringing a bell. Josh, you're on top of things. Thank you. But anyway, so yeah, please, everyone, keep in touch. Let me know if we have any service to you. You know, I'm a big fan of your chapter, and I'm happy to be of any help.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, this has been a great hour. I feel like it was combined practical story time, really.
Yes. That's what I like to go for. You might need some fun history stories to make it, you know, I feel like that's the way it works in my mind. At least that stories stick with my, in my head, and sort of platitudes. I just, they go in one ear, one out the other.
Oh, but thank you so much. Do you have any final words to say? We are here now at the top of the hour. So
I would say, don't be discouraged. Get out there and vote tomorrow. Regardless of, you know, please don't view this as a team sport, as everyone is doing now. You know, regardless of who wins, we are all Americans. We will, you know, keep pushing for your ideals, and be loud about it, be involved, be, like I said before, be running, please. I'd love to see your names. I'm looking at these names. I'm going to start writing them down. I want to see them on ballots sometime in the near future. And stay connected with your friends and classmates. They'll be great friends. And, you know, even the ones, regardless of your ideology, that's how you strengthen your thoughts and your arguments, is by contending with all different sorts of peoples and viewpoints.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.